Maybe I'll start. Let me see. I'll talk about a couple of things. Maybe I'll talk about being religious in the secular business world. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about starting out, like things, you know, even starting out, you know, things you do in college and things I did when I was younger. And maybe I'll talk a bit about business as I guess I should say something about tzedakah, so I'll say something about tzedakah because he said I'm a gadol in tzedakah, so I should say something, right? And I'll talk a little bit about businesses at tzedakah. So let me start with the last thing. You remind me of the four things in case I forget. I'll start with the last thing, business as a tzedakah. I once wrote in a book that I think that I picked out General Motors as a bad example, but I should have picked out Ford. But I said I think Ford's done more good than all the tzedakahs in the world. Because Ford has like given employment to tremendous numbers of people, and they've allowed tremendous numbers of people to go visit their grandmothers and their friends and so forth and so on. And when you really get involved in the tzedakah, everybody's always fighting with each other and like not that much gets done sometimes. Even though later I'm going to talk about how important tzedakah is, but the purpose of a business, the way most businesses work, is you have to satisfy everybody's needs. You have to satisfy the needs of the consumer or the client, and you have to satisfy the needs, the economic wants of the, you know, employee. I mean, the whole thing is about making people happy, unless you're a slumlord. But if you're in a business where people have a choice, what they want to do, everything is about making people happy. So then we add another layer onto that. I'm in business anyway. I would especially like to. I was in the phone business. I am in the phone business. We carry 1/6 of all the international calls in the world. And we invented internet telephony, and we got paid like over $1 billion from AT&T for part of the business, and we invented the debit card. Most of the debit cards that all the Spanish people use to make calls are ours. And we've made a lot of money doing these things, but there's no great satisfaction. There's no great satisfaction in providing the product. Like when I came around, it used to cost $3 to make an international call. Now it costs only like 5 cents. So it's like, is that what you want in your gravestone? You know, you lowered the price for call from $2.95 savings. That's what Howard did, you know, in his lifetime. It's like, it's okay, you know, it makes money. But it's not, so if they had to pay more, they would pay more. It's not such a great accomplishment in and of itself. There was a lot of great accomplishments along the way. There's the thrill of like innovating and the thrill of bringing a new product to market and so forth and so on. But you know, I think the good thing we did along the way is we hired a tremendous number of Jews. Maybe 40% of the company, maybe 50%, you know, were from Jews. Like, you know, any Jew who didn't have a job came to us, you know, we were able to hire them. Maybe I hired too many. You know, because there was a time when things got tough and we had to, you know, cut down. But they really did. They're very smart. They're very hardworking. In general, they're very honest, and you felt a sense of heaven. You know, these are your people, you know, and why not give them the opportunities? And also, you know, the truth is that they probably were in some ways cheaper than other guys, because, you know, when things were tough, we had a lot of guys that got poached by like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and so forth, and they paid them like double and triple, you know, we were paying. And obviously the guys were happier working with us because, you know, Chavez, Yantif, they have minions in the office, they have a yeshiva in the office, they have kosher food, you know, they feel everybody has each other's back. So we probably were able to get a lot better talent than we were able to by virtue of bringing on firm guys. Then I went totally insane. Maybe I didn't go totally insane, but maybe I went totally insane. I decided I'm going to solve the unemployment problem in Yerushalayim. You know, we retired. I made a mistake. Don't retire. It's a bad idea. That's a little side thing. It's not a worthwhile goal to retire. It's because that means, like, you know, you just want to be useless. But I made that mistake twice. I made the mistake when I was 30, and I made the mistake again in 2002. I'm 58 now, 57. I don't know, 13 years ago. So I made the mistake again when I was like 45, you know, in that neighborhood. I hope I don't make it. I hope it's not every 15-year mistake. But we moved to Yerushalayim, and I was sort of bored, and I thought, you know, there are all these unemployed, you know, people in Yerushalayim. I'm going to open a call center, and I'm going to hire all the Anglos in Yerushalayim who don't have a job to come work for me. So eventually, I hired 1,000 people to come work for me and take calls. And there was a number of problems. The big problem was that we lost money, or that we lost a ton of money, because it's much cheaper to do the job in India than it is to do in Israel. The specific problem that made things difficult was the shekel kept getting stronger. So the shekel moved from 5 shekels to the dollar to close to 3 shekels to the dollar. And if you're paying everybody in shekels, it raises your price by 40 or 60, whatever it is. It made it unprofitable, whereas originally it was breaking even. The biggest mistake was probably trying to do it all at once. That, you know, I had no experience running a call center before, and suddenly, you know, running one and just taking on any client I could. AOL, you know, AOL was a terrible client, because the idea was when people call up to cancel, not to let them cancel. So people having nervous breakdowns, people could only work on this account for like 3-4 weeks until they like couldn't take it anymore. You know, because I guess Jews internalized it. It was a noble experiment. You know, it didn't work out, but even if it didn't work out, 1,000 people had jobs for 2 or 3 years, and a lot of them got on their feet in Israel, a lot of them, that was their first job. You know, people are often upset at you, you know, when you have to cut back, you have to let somebody go, but, you know, if you gave them a job for 10 years or 15 years, you know, you supported that family for 10 or 15 years. You know, and the person got to advance, and so I think that's a very important thing. I think it's worthwhile and important. Okay, then after things got, then I decided that I didn't want, you know, the business anymore to just do good by, you know, hiring Jews or something. I want the business itself to become an instrument for changing the world. And I know not everybody has to make the business an instrument for changing the world. But there are some things that are instruments for changing the world, right? If you cure cancer, you change the world in some way. Anyway. I decided when I was 17, there was a big oil crisis in the States, the Arabs cut off the oil after the 73 war. And there were long gas lines, and they made it that how your license plate ended, if it was even, you go on even days, and if it was odd, you could go on odd days. And even so, there were tremendous lines, and when you got to the gas pump, they would only give you 5 gallons or 10 gallons, whatever was the allotment that was allowed for that day. And you know, 17-year-old kid, like, it stunk, you know. I mean, I thought, like, I'm going to be able to drive wherever I wanted to, and had a girlfriend, I'm going to be able to, you know, car, girlfriend, you know, like, well, what else could you want? Happens I married her, when I was on one of these lines, they were talking about that America has these vast reserves of shale oil in Colorado, and that there's 3 times as much shale oil in Colorado as there is oil in the whole world. And it got in my head that, you know, first of all, I thought, of course there's shale in Colorado. Because, you know, like they always make the joke, you know, and Gideon, and, you know, why do they talk about divorce before marriage? Because God always creates the cure before he creates the problem. So it's of course there's oil in Colorado, because America's a special place. It's been a special place for Jews. You know, even though there's a Russia in the White House now, you know, America's made it possible, you know, for Israel to exist. And so it would only be reasonable that America should have these vast reserves, that God would have put them there. And for sure, these big companies, Exxon and Shell and Sunoco, and so, they're going to tap this wealth. That was something I had in my head when I was 17. I mean, I could not, I'm not an oil company, you know, I'm not 17, I'm going to go out there and figure out what to do. Well, something was always on my mind. So when I unretired, and I retired like 2004, when I unretired in 2007, I decided I want to solve the oil crisis. And I want to get one of the 5 experimental plots out in Colorado. So I got one of the plots, and you know, sometimes like God just, you could just feel his hand in things. I got one of the plots, and I was looking for scientists, and scientists came to me from Livermore, and he told me he has this new idea, a patent that'll work with convection on the mud underneath the aquifers, because people were very upset that there were aquifers that run through the shale rocks in Colorado. When you turn them to oil, it's gonna make the water all dirty. And I hired this scientist, must have been 2 weeks later, that Total, the giant French oil company, one of the 10 big oil companies in the world, showed up and said, you have this patent and you have this land, we're going to pay 80% of all the expenses, you know, that you're going to incur on this, and we only want to be 50% partners. So that was pretty good, you know. I was partnered with Total and we were doing this thing. I had no idea what we were doing. But scientists told me it's going to make oil, you know, so I thought it would make oil. And I would read all the literature, you know, and all the literature basically says, and again, you know, it's an interesting thing that, just an aside, but as an aside, the Nazis caused all these Jewish scientists who invented the atomic bomb to run away and come to the United States. And as a result of their coming to the United States, 2 things happened. One, it became impossible that the Nazis would ever win the war, because had the war gone a little bit longer, Berlin would have gone the way of Hiroshima, you know, and Munich and so forth and so on. We wouldn't have needed any Russians or anybody else to invade. There wouldn't have been any war. You know, as it was, it ended the war, you know, somewhat early. The second thing that I thought on this topic is that the scientists turned the whole world into Jews. Because, you know, what's part of the nature of being Jewish? Part of the nature of being Jewish is you never know what tomorrow's going to be. You know, get thrown out of this country, somebody's going to attack you, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. Now, everybody in the world, yeah, people don't worry so much now as when I was kids and you had to do go under the desk once a week, you know, to prepare for the atomic explosion. But everybody in the world could be wiped out at any moment. You know, Putin could go, you know, insane or whatever. And so it spread that. But in any event, I read all the literature about what was going on in so the reason I mentioned it is because the way that the process to turn shale into oil was developed was in 1940, the Nazis took the oil away from the Swedes. And the Swedes had this rock, you know, called shale, which means that it has a high organic content, it has something in it which is the precursor of oil. And when you heat it up, that's what nature does when it's deep down in the ground, like in Saudi. When you heat it up, it becomes oil. So the Swedes were smart enough to put electric heaters into the ground, and they used their hydropowers to run the heater. And what do you know? As vapor, the oil came up as vapor, the Swedes captured it, the didn't even come up as oil, it came up as finished product in some cases, but they captured it. They put it into units where they cooled it down, and they used that oil to run Sweden from 1940 to 1960. So in 1960, when they ran out of oil, they came to the United States to sell their technology. But at that time, oil was only $1, $2 a barrel. You could just, you know, put a hole in Texas, you had all the oil you wanted. And so nobody was particularly interested in the technology, and it fell to the side. After the 73 oil crisis, when it was desperate for oil, they had forgotten about this, you know, signs that existed in Sweden. And they started, we have a guy working for us now, ran Union Carbide then. They just blew up mountains. They set them on fire, you know, because if the mountains were on fire, they would leak oil. And they created oil that way from 73 to 82. It was dirty, it was expensive, it wasn't the best way to do things. They didn't know what the best way to do things was. And in 82, when oil dropped from $30 a barrel to 10, it became not a good thing to do. So they fired 20,000 people and they stopped. And in that same year, 82, Shell ran into a problem in California. They ran out of oil in California. They had only this heavy, gunky oil that was left in the wells. And, you know, it's called Royal Dutch Shell. Shell was actually founded by Jews. Was actually the two sons of somebody who had a seashell company who used to import seashells from Indonesia. So when they discovered oil in Indonesia, the guys who had all the ships were the guys, the Samuel brothers, who were importing the seashells so they could make these little jewelry boxes and stuff with seashells on them. So they asked them to do it. And they figured out that they couldn't really put it in a shell boat, can't fill a seashell boat with oil, but they built the first oil tankers. And the big question was, could they bring them through the Suez Canal? This is completely removed from anything I thought I was going to talk about, but could they bring them through the Suez Canal? And it was up to Winston Churchill. And the Jewish brothers went to Winston Churchill and said, listen, Exxon tried to say no, Standard Oil of New Jersey. There wasn't just Exxon, they owned all the oil companies. They had a monopoly. And they didn't want this oil coming through the Suez Canal because it would break their monopoly. So Jewish brothers went to Churchill and they said, listen, Churchill was then the Minister of the Admiralty, and back in like 1915, 1916, they said, look, if you'll have a war and the Americans have to be neutrals, they have to stay out, or, you know, whatever the cause is, England won't have any oil. But if you let us, you know, bring things through the canal, we're a British company. Actually, they were half British and half Dutch. But we're a British company. We'll supply the fleet with oil. And just then Churchill was converting the fleet from coal to oil, so he said, okay. So that was the beginning of Shell. Later on, another group came to him and said, this is just interesting, you know. Another group, Tim, came to him when they found oil in Iran and said, you know what? How are you going to trust these Jews you know, Jews, they're always out for themselves, they're crooked, they'll undermine you and so forth and so on. If there's a war, why don't you give us the rights? You know, we'll be a partly British-owned company, partly owned by the British government, and we'll supply you oil, and you won't have to depend on the Jews. And that's how BP came into effect, with the Iranian oil from, with Iranian oil. When World War II came, Marcus Samuels, who ran the company, had his people blow up every oil well, blow it up in a way that it couldn't be reopened, blow up every oil well that was anywhere near that the Japanese could get through, their best wells in Indonesia and so forth and so on. And as a result, he lost control of the company. The company went over to the Dutch. Eventually it went over to this lunatic who was a Nazi who wanted to move it, but the British government seized it. But Churchill was wrong. Like, you could depend on the Jews. In any event, in 1982, Shell decided to try to solve the heavy oil problem, and the chief scientist of Shell was somebody who grew up in the Netherlands, and you remember when he was a little boy, there was something going on in Sweden where they were heating things up with heaters and so forth and so on, and they sent over this, you know, Jewish PhD from Harvard who they'd hired, like the guy graduated first in his class, you know, Harold Vinegar, to check it out. And that became, and he got all their records, and Shell started a 30-year process to perfect those methods so that they could use them in Colorado. And in 2004, they were perfected. They convinced the Bush administration to open up Colorado for exploration. Three of the five leases went to Shell. They're about to go into production, and then Democrats got elected in Colorado and wouldn't accept their pollution abatement technologies, and Democrats got elected to the House in 2006 and didn't want to, you know, extend any of the leases. And so at the time that I called up Howard Vinegar, he was very unhappy because, unbeknownst to me, Shell was about to move all their operations to Jordan. Because the greatest deposit of shale in the world happens to be in Israel. And Jordan used to be just north of Israel. It's where Lebanon is now. And over the ages, it worked its way down to the Dead Sea Rift. And in working its way down, the whole country got all rubbleized, so nothing's next to anything else. It has a lot of high quality minerals in it because this algae, when it died, is what created the kerogen. It's the organic matter that oil turns into. But in Israel, it's one solid piece. One solid piece. There's one piece we have on our territory that has 50 million barrels on it. So anyway, I called up Harold Vinegar, and I told him everything I was doing. And Harold told me, "You're an idiot." So I said, "You know, if you say I'm an idiot, it must be the case. You're the smartest guy in the industry." I said, "But I was thinking maybe I could do this." And he said, "That's also stupid." I said, "Oh, well, this is terrible. Everything I'm doing is stupid, you know." I said, "Why are you even talking to me if I'm so stupid?" So he said, "You wouldn't be so stupid if you went after the oil in Israel." So I said, "Well, is that because you would do it with me?" And he said, "I might." So I said, "I'll be in Houston in your office tomorrow. Just come at night to my house." So I came at night to his house, and it wound up that Israel, when they found all this oil, had approached Shell, asked them to come in, and Shell wouldn't come in because of the boycott. Years later, Dick Cheney and I went to Exxon, and Exxon was about to do the deal. We actually had it on paper after they did all the diligence. They had to go to the Saudis to get permission. The Saudis said no. So I know why, I know why Shell didn't go in. But anyway, the minute we showed up in Israel, they said, if you have Howard Vinegar, we're going to give you the whole middle of the country. So I went with Howard Vinegar, they gave me the whole middle of the country, and I said, "Now, this is a project, this is what I'm in business for. You know, I don't want to be in business to sell telephone calls and everything, I want to be an oil man. I want to make 250 billion barrels of oil in Israel and put the Arabs out of business." And, you know, while we've been working on the oil in Israel, we've also found some in Mongolia and some other interesting, you know, things. But the most interesting thing we found is we found that a very little bit of the oil, a very little bit of the shale had already turned into oil. So I thought, somebody else thought, gee, if only a little bit of it turned into oil in this spot, maybe there's someplace else in Israel where it's hot, and more would have turned into oil. So the scientists got to thinking, when I say scientists, I'm talking, we actually have the great scientists in the world. It's like, you know, three guys who are the smartest guys in the world are much better than 100 guys who are like from the middle of the class, you know. These guys started thinking, and they started thinking, you know what? Forgetting about creationism, these guys like lived the Paleolithic age and the Neolithic age, and they imagine how things formed and how they were. I mean, they see the whole sequence in their head. Like, they imagine, just like you with Washington, like what day he had a bad day and why he had a fight with Martha, and that day why he went out and hired Hamilton, and so, you know, I understand this kind of stuff. So they said, well, listen, the Golan is full of oil. You know, we figured it out, there's volcanoes in the Golan. And, you know, there's even a live one, the Ein Said, so that there's a hot spring there. And the whole Golan is full of oil, you know, and we project that there's 60 billion barrels of oil in the Golan. So there's only one problem. Israel doesn't allow any drilling in the Golan. So we had to convince Israel to open up the Golan for drilling. That's very hard, because nobody wants the responsibility of, like, World War III. So no minister would sign it, and we went to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister said he would help us, but the ministers kept chickening out at the last minute. So then I went to Rav Avadia Yosef, you know, and told him he should talk to the Shas Minister, because he's the head of the Ministry of the Interior. So I went and told him the whole story. When I got done, he slaps my face back and forth. That's how Sfarim give a bracha. And he told me my kid should live a long life, and I should do well and prosper. And I said, oh, what a bracha. So I'm sitting in his apartment, and I said, you know, this is not what I wanted. So I talked to his daughter-in-law, who's like, she's in charge of everything. And she goes up, talks to him, he's learning with his like group. And he says, in an hour, the Rebbe will see you. So in an hour, I went and I told him the story again. For 15 minutes, he was looking at me and smiling. Everything had to be translated out. The whole history of Israel is riding on his doing something, telling Shas and everybody that they have to rise up and so forth. So when I finish, right, a really long bracha, you know, that included that we'll succeed with this thing and so forth, you know. But I said, I was thinking, there's a certain holiness in this place. I was thinking, you know what, maybe this bracha is better than whatever I came for, you know. So I left, and shortly after that, the Shas Minister, Eli Yishai, who was the Minister of the Interior, said, he'll sign if this other chicken minister signs at the same time. And the other minister was not going to sign it, but Benny Begin showed up and said, he was the one who originally found it. He was the chief geologist of Israel. And at this point, he was deputy prime minister. He said, if this guy doesn't sign, I'm going to sign. And you're going to be eternally embarrassed that your name wasn't on this paper. So the other guy signed. You know, so then Golan was open. Then the oil minister quit his job and tried to bid against us for it, you know. But somehow by miracle we got the whole thing, and we found out that that in 1982 the water company went to drill a well in southern Golan near Ein Said, and the well filled up with oil. And they were pissed because they wanted water, you know, so they had to get another bit, and, you know, the bit caught fire because it was with the oil, and so, you know, till they drilled this hole, they were, like, totally miserable. And it was too far down, and the oil and everything, so they didn't drill any more holes there. They just followed their report, it got stuck on some shelf, but we found it. You know, and every hole that's been drilled in Israel for the last 60 years, they have thousands of holes. There's a box with the dirt from that hole. So we had to find that box of dirt. So we found a box of dirt. We sent it to the National Lab in the United States. They said, whoa, you got this from West Texas. I said, no, we got this from Israel. I said, that's unbelievable. I said, no. So anyway, June 15th, we're supposed to start drilling. in the middle of the goal line, which will tell us if the story is true. Like maybe there's just a little oil in the south, or maybe it really is Kuwait, you know? So that has us like excited. That has us excited because if you can turn the business into like, you know, that you could actually accomplish, you know, the business itself is accomplishing something besides like the side thing that accomplishes, that's sort of interesting. Okay, so I'll stop that topic. I'll go to, how much time do I have? I don't want to like
10 minutes.
Like 5 minutes?
We'll give you 15.
15. Okay, talk about being a Jew in business. I may not get to everything. I found that it's a big advantage to be a Jew in business. Only one time it worked against me. One time, first let me tell you what times it worked for me. You cannot believe how far out of their way, I will not say internationally, but in the United States, you can't believe how far out of their way people will go, particularly outside of New York, particularly Christians, to bend over and give Jews a chance, and in New York too. And you come into somebody's office, you know, you're wearing a yarmulke, and you make a presentation to them, what do you think, you're like a priest, you know, you won't be lying, you know, in general, like, and also, like, you're, it's hard to be like prejudiced against you because it's like right in their face. You know, like they have to give you. Now it's good to start the conversation talking about fishing, or camping, or football, or so forth. Because you know, a little conversation like that convinces them you're a regular guy, you don't have horns, and so forth and so on. And you know, and then you could get into the business. But you know, I've always forced the issue that you know I'm kosher, I'm Jewish, and so forth and so on. And great things happened. One time I was at the White House and I was too away from Bush. And, you know, often when they give you these kosher dinners, they come with all this tape around it, you know, to show that it's kosher from whatever restaurant. And every time Bush would talk, I would pull the tape, so, you know, twice, he's the president, you know, I decided, I'll eat later. So he stopped, you know, and he said, you're not going to open the food, you know, he says, you know, because the tape, you know, and it's kosher. He says, you know, I didn't invite you to the White House, so you should start. Give it to me. I'll be your Shabbos Goy. I'll open it. So, that was the best one. It was the president opening up. But Pat Robertson brought, like, a rabbi, you know, to supervise our meal, and, you know, on the top of the Montgomery Tower, and the top of the Transamerica Tower in San Francisco. You know, they brought a kosher caterer for the first time, one time I went to Texas, people drove 8 hours back and forth to get a grill so they could make a barbecue for us. But you know, after they drive 8 hours back and forth to make a barbecue for you, you could be sure they're going to sign a contract with you. Like they don't, you know, like when people like put the effort in. And like I said, and in the United States, I can't say that for international, but in the United States, I have never really encountered, maybe I've lived some charmed life, but I've never really encountered prejudice in business. The only time I can remember is one time when I was a kid, I used to deliver brochures, you know, to hotel lobbies. And I was at I had this client who was at the airport, and he was on the, like, departure level. And I went without a yarmulke, I sold him the account, it was called New York Airways. And then I went upstairs to the arrival level, I put on my yarmulke, and then he came upstairs, he saw me in the arrivals level with the yarmulke. By the time I got back to the office, he canceled the contract. He felt like I pulled something over on him, you know, like this Jew came in and tricked me. Because a lot of these guys are military, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, if you watch it off, like from the beginning, I think you get exceptional treatment and exceptional entree, and you meet some exceptional people. So, in the 7 minutes remaining to me, to say a few words about charity, oh my God, what could you say? I think it's a very good thing. I think a person should give 20% of their income. I always have. I mean, there's all these people who need help. I mean, we even put aside money just to help people come to us, but there's a tremendous feeling of satisfaction. Sometimes the charities don't work, but this tremendous feeling of satisfaction when you see that something you do does work, that some you know, institutionally or individually, like some hopeless couple has a baby, or some, you know, some people who didn't have medical care get the medical care, or hungry people eat, or, you know, people who you know, are having psychological problems are able to get over to some, just tremendous satisfaction, tremendous self-rewarding, and then you wind up here and there, like, you know, meeting people who sometimes, you know, you do things with, I mean, you're meeting people who have your values, so sometimes you do things with them together. I mean, sometimes you don't meet any. Like, I mean, I met, you know, I was on the board of some really important organizations like Presbyterian Hospital and AIPAC and stuff, where, like, I met nobody who I did anything with. And I was on the board of some, like, really half-ass organizations where, you know, I met, like, Partners for Life. So, yeah, I mean, you can never tell. Like, you know, you don't know, like, what good deed. I mean, just you don't know what good deed is gonna We had this. These are not institutional. I mean, these are just whatever. But my daughter had this friend, and the friend was, there's something wrong with her. You know, she was not 100% like, you know, in the right way. So my daughter's very happily married. She's married to a guy who, you know, was a rabbi here for a while, but now I corrupted him, and he's in business with me. But she came to live in our house. I didn't even know she lived in our house, you know, because she's a very quiet little girl, like, you know, stays on the in the guest room on the first floor. But one time my wife and I were shopping, and she asked me, do you like the yogurt with the fruit or without the fruit? Because I see you always eat it, and you leave the fruit. You know, so you like to get a little bit of the fruit, or you want it all. I said, I like without the fruit, you know, plain. I said, oh, then I'm going to have to buy both kinds of yogurt because Janet likes it with the fruit. I said, Janet's living with us? I said, yes. She said, yes, you've been living with us for a year. What's wrong with you? Oh, anyway. So you know, we've had a lot of people living with us. Some worked out, some not. And this other guy, he's a little, whatever, you know, he's a little different, you know, so I have him, like, pick up my mail and go through the checks, and, you know, because the business used to be in the house, so there's still some mail that comes to the house, you know. Anyway, the two of them got married. He's 57, she's 24. They just had their first baby. You know, it's like, it's a miracle. I mean, we had this other couple, we adopted this kid. We forced the parent of this kid. He was a terrible kid, terrible, terrible. He's the worst kid in the whole system. He was, like, a very hard kid to deal with. So we used to have this guy be a shadow come on Shabbos. So we got close to the shadow. He's like, just a nice guy, and he worked for Ohel, and then he met his Besher, and he got married, and they were so happy. And then after they married for like 3 months, he went crazy. He went crazy, completely crazy. He wanted to kill her, and they couldn't live together, and they were fighting, and he was making holes in the walls. And this guy was like the most nuttiest person you ever met. And, you know, we got him, like, psychiatric counseling, and they were already trying to help his wife get out of the marriage. I never saw anybody want to stay in the marriage as much as this girl. But, and I would drive around with him all night telling him about, you know, how he could fix his problems, how he should be nice to her, you know. Anyway, they got back together, they got all warm, and now they're having a baby, and they go to people's houses, and they're happy, and, like, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. You know, I mean, it's a little miracle, right? It's not as big a miracle building a hospital, but, you know, little miracles count also. You know, sometimes little miracles count for more. The last thing I was going to talk about, and I'll spend only 2 or 3 minutes on this, is what you could do now. But, you know, I started in business in high school, and I was in business in college, and, you know, I ran a mail order business out of my room. I distributed brochures when I was in high school. I still have the brochure distribution business. It's grown into some other things. But what I think is, like, we're starting a business now of wiring money. We have, like, about a few 100,000 stores where they sell our debit cards. And all Spanish people come in and put down a couple of dollars, and they wire it, it goes onto our system. We said, we have this whole system, why don't we also use it for wiring money? So, you know, we had to get licenses and all the states to wire the money. It's very complicated, but now they're wiring money every week, like the amount of money we wire doubles. And I know it's a great business. Okay, the reason I know it's a great business is because I'm just watching, I'm just keeping my eye on like two stores in Florida and one in, you know, Texas that a friend went into, because, you know, I have a friend who's a salesman for the company, and he tells me how these three stores do. And these three stores keep doing better and better. They're wiring like thousands of doing thousands of wires a week. And I think anything that one store could do, 1,000 stores could do, anything, if you could do any, like one thing and you could get it right, you know, you can make it profitable, then there's no reason that you can't like grow that and grow that and grow that and grow that. The whole trick is getting like one little thing right. So like whatever little thing you decide to do, you know, I'm not saying that there'll be Golan Heights, you know, lava places all over the country, but who knows, you know, but any one thing that you could get right, like once you get it right, then you could figure out how to make it repetitive. You could figure out how to build in, you know, what we call redundancy and scalability and blah, 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 you know, so, and you get a lot of experience. You know, you learn all the things that could go wrong. And life, I think the fun is in the adventure. I think the fun is in the journey, not in getting there. Like when the oil finally comes out and you're an old guy sitting in a wheelchair, like what fun is it, you know? The fun is fighting with the ministers and getting the ship and so forth and so on. I mean, the whole fun is whatever you're doing, it's in the journey. So I think it's a fun journey. I think you do a lot of good things along the way. I don't know what this eccentric talk covered, what Robert Willick had in mind to cover, but... whatever, you know, you're freaking eccentric, you get an eccentric talk. Is there any questions anyone wants to, is the time for questions?
Yeah.
Is there any questions anyone wants to ask? I'll answer anything.
When did you go for college and what did you major?
Okay, there's two answers. I went to Harvard. I majored in economics. That's the fancy answer. The true answer is my wife was a year behind me in high school, and I don't really want to go to college, but her parents said she's not going to Boston unless she gets into Harvard, and then, you know, when she got in, I had no choice but to follow her. So I barely showed up at classes. They were terrible. I was running my business. There were a couple interesting philosophy things and things at the business school, but I greatly regret I'm about to go, that I didn't go to YU. And when I got out, I took the JSS curriculum. I was not officially registered here as a student. I didn't come out rich, but the dean at the time, Rabbi Uden, said that I could, you know, take the syllabus. And that's what I do in college.
Do you think the world is still like that, where you can just kind of push through and like start small and grow?
Yes, in different ways than it was when I was. One of the problems with the world is that they've cut out. There's a lot of problems with the world. Like there are no more jobs for men with muscles. You know, that's part of the reason countries falling apart. If guys used to work in factories or do road work or this and that, like they automated all that. So now all the women are earning more. They can't find guys who are earning anything. And this whole group of men who have nothing to do, families are falling apart, so forth and so on. And while they were at it, you know, the McDonald's and the chain restaurants, they also cut out like a lot of the restaurants and you know, all the kind of little things that existed when you were a kid that you could get into it have largely become chains. But new things keep getting invented. And the really big opportunities are with the new things. So the really big opportunities are with new things. Oh, with, you know, like, okay, people are doing apps now, so you figure out, okay, what like people tell me two ideas. I mean, maybe they don't make any sense, you know. But I told my son, you know, my son wants to get into a good college. I said, start a business with an app. Then it'll go on your resume. Even if you don't make any money, though, you know, he'll be excited. But you know, he has this app going where his friends from school can order from the kosher restaurant on the other side of Riverdale, and everybody's on the phone all the time. Like he's raking it in with this crazy app. I mean, it seems to me you should have to work and go pick up the food to make money. I like to see people sweat. But, you know, somebody told me an idea the other day that all these guys from, you know, when you deliver food to an office building, they're all standing at the desk downstairs and they cancel security and people have to come through and so on and so on. Why don't you set up a set of lockers? You know, and near the loading dock or whatever, and the people from the different restaurants can put their food like in the locker, and the locker will send up a text that the food is there, and they'll keep it. I don't know, like maybe somebody can put a bomb in the locker and blow up the whole building, but you know, but if we can work out the kinks, like it's interesting, you know. So I think there are a lot of things to hustle. It's just, you know, a lot of the traditional ways to hustle have been limited, and so unfortunately you have to be smarter. You know, not as much opportunity for people who, you know, willing to work hard but aren't as bright.
So Sean, as I know, we know that you're very supportive of, you have yeshiva IDT.
Right.
There are other Jewish yeshivas you're involved with. Just give us a minute of why you feel that's such an important cause. I've never heard of a business that has a yeshiva as part of the business.
It may grow a lot. I mean, it's a little smaller than it was. Look, we thought that I guess I give like a reasonable. I'm not happy about the whole situation with the Haredim don't want to go into the army in Israel and they're turning it into life. The whole thing is just a bad situation. But, you know, I was involved with this guy. We started Nachal Haredi. And the idea was to get, you know, Haredi people to want to join the army. I remember our first battalion. They were so terrible. There used to be the show on TV, F Troop. We went to visit it, like with my wife and kids. First, they didn't know where to let her in because she was a woman. Then they decided, being she's my wife, they'll let her in. And they didn't know what to do with the kids, so they let them in the ammunition room. You know? And you know, father's like, you know, but my wife went in. She says, this is live ammunition. Like, the kids were holding hand grenades. They just didn't know how to play. But, you know, this group, like, supposedly caught a terrorist, but really it was the, you know, Bnei Akiva guy with them who caught the terrorists. But you know, they got them better. They got them better from the beginning. But I think people need to be integrated into society. And so we thought, listen, we'll start a yeshiva in the building, and we'll train people, you know, in technology work, and we'll get them a college degree at the same time. And the best ones, you know, we'll keep them. We've gotten some very good guys out of yeshiva, and, you know, everybody who's come through it has gotten a job and done well. And it gives, like, a certain good character to the company, you know, that people can go down there and daven, and they can learn when they want and so forth. And now we're starting a company for internet security, and, you know, being a phone company, we've had to work with the CIA and the FBI and all that kind of thing, and we have one guy who came to us. It's unbelievable. When he came to us, this was the last person in the world who you would ever think would be from, to come from. But he came from, now he's a beard, he's a Chabadnik. And he's like the top expert on security in the world. And he wants to like take on like 100 guys, you know, from Crown Heights and so on, and turn them into security experts, and we'll keep the best ones because there's such a need for security people if this new business will work. I don't know, we'll see if it really blossoms, you know, if that happens. But I have a son who, like, is very down on the, he's a little down on the amount of charity we give, you know, because some of it comes from the business foundation and so forth, and like, he doesn't like to prove any expenses. It's like, I'm trying to sneak some ink over to the legal office we have in Manhattan because he thinks they've used up their toner quota. And it's like, are you crazy? Like, these are our contracts. Like, they used up the toner quota, so we're not going to have any contracts for a month. So, you know, like, I'm ordering via Amazon. I'm going to bring it down to under the car, you know? So you can imagine when he has to write a check, like, for $100,000 to Yeshiva, how he feels. Like, you know, what are we going to, you know? But even he, like, thinks that this is, that the, you know, having Yeshiva in our own office is good for, it's good for morale, it's good for the office, and so forth and so on. And so, you know, I don't get a big fight about that.
Two things. First off, you mentioned Nahal Faridi. I actually was there last year serving, and this year they actually won the Chief of Staff's prize, like the best battalion in the Army.
Really?
So, yeah, it's great that, actually 15 years later, I guess, you know, we have to be really proud of them. The other thing is that when you mentioned how you have the yeshiva in, you know, as part of your business, how do the non-Jews or the religious people feel about it? Do they feel like we are taking resources away that we can be using for other projects? Or are they okay with this? Say, this is a great thing?
Well, hey, two things. We get a lot of, we just got tremendous benefit from going broke. You know, like we, you know, after I retired, the business started to do bad, and we started to do terrible in 2007. So we got saved in 2008 when everybody else did terrible, because then everybody was cutting deals. And, but it's like after that, one thing, everybody's sort of happy to have a job. You know, the people, you know, stayed with us, and, you know, so there's not so. I remember in the old days, you know, we used to have, like, religious classes. And then people start to complain, oh, you don't have religious classes for other religions, you know. So we had this guy who was a minister, you know, giving one of these Jesus classes or whatever. And I would go to the Jesus class too. So show that, you know, listen, I love all employees, you know, like even the ones who, like, you know. But I guess the quirky thing about us, the quirky thing that's evolved, is that, you know, I said like half of us is from Jews. Maybe it's 35 or 40%, and maybe it's 35 or 40% or 45% Hispanic, because, you know, we sell a lot of products, like I said, to the Hispanic community. And it's like the Hispanics, they just like to party. You know, they like to work. They like to party. You know, Jews like to go to their parties, they put some kosher food, but Jews have had this kind of, you know, music and dancing and so forth. You know, and they get along relatively well. And like Spanish people, they don't aggravate for anything. Like, you know, and when they get taken advantage of, it's a bad thing. We had like a group who was like, came out and they were just putting less minutes on the debit cards and chipping everybody, and you were able to take advantage of them because they don't like run to the authorities, you know, the way some different ethnic groups do. But they're very, like I said, they're a very happy group of people, you know, they have senior positions. And so there's nobody to complain, you know, if they wanted to have like a Spanish religious group, you know, we would have one, but like I said, they're just happy. I mean, you know, if somebody wanted to be accommodated, we would accommodate them. You know, I mean, we you know, having a few thousand employees, we fall under all these rules of treating everybody equally. So there's equal access to everything. It's just, you know, not something that other people are interested in at this time.
It seems that another thing that you've done really successfully is to choose really good people to work with. And I was wondering if you could give us any tips on what to look for, like outside of obviously just getting the brightest PhD from Harvard and geophysics.
Oh my God, what a hard question. No, well, you know, the thing is, I feel like I've gone through four business revolutions. The first time I went in, I got guys that were really, just really talented and brilliant. And the problem was that even though they were religious, they didn't think that much of secular law. And so they created a lot of problems that, you know, fortunately we were able to solve. But, you know, if we wouldn't have solved them, you know, it would have been ugly. you know, then I got a bunch of firm guys really good, but they were like power crazy and wanted to throw me out. So that was like pretty bad, you know. You know, so then the third time I got guys who were a little bit more brilliant but gentle, you know, who weren't going to like steal or throw me out, and things were much better, except, you know, there wasn't like a lot of vigor in things. You know, now I finally have like guys who are vigorous and smart and so on. It's very, very hard. I mean, all these people look at, experience is a very good, you know, of course, hiring people for the first job, it's hard to know, but experience is a very good predictor. You know, so somebody who's been in a job for a long time, done well, wants to change jobs, show some stability, but also success, like good person to hire. You know, if you're looking at, like, right off the bat, some of the best people I have, but not everybody's in a position to do this. But there are some people who have spectacular failures. Right, I think that anybody who's great is always going to push the limit. Right, it's never enough for Evel Knievel to just jump over 10 buses. Like, you know, when he gets done jumping over 10 buses, he has to jump over 20. When he gets jumping over 20, he has to jump over, right, Niagara Falls. If he gets over Niagara Falls, he has to jump over Grand Canyon. Sooner or later, he's going to fall down into something and break his legs. Because it's the time to hire him is when he breaks his legs. You know, when he falls, you know, and we've got some really spectacular people. So there's a guy who's president of AOL, and he was the one they wanted to pin the whole, you know, crime on of, you know, pumping up the numbers to make AOL the equivalent of Time Warner. And he became firm, and the government was after him for years, and you know,
David Colburn.
Yeah, David Colburn. Right. So he works for me. Right, and he's totally loyal because, like, I took him when he was radioactive. Like, right now, you know, he has a yacht and boatyards and lots of business. And, like, anybody wants to hire David Colburn. But, like, sometimes if you befriend somebody who really has done something great and then it hasn't worked out and you befriend them when they're at the bottom, they don't always hit the bottom. But if you befriend them when they're at the bottom, yeah, like I have a particular friend, you know, this guy who I said, I don't know if I said at the beginning, gave $20 million to some charity or something, but, you know, he got in a lot of trouble, and I was able to get his sentence reduced, and I used to fly out to Alabama to visit him, like, every week, and, you know, now, I mean, like I said, now we give $20 million to a charity, like, you know, the guy's a billionaire, but it's like, anytime I want to see him, it's like, you were there for me when I was in prison. Like, you know, it's like, so some of these relationships you have to earn, and some of them you have to risk on. I mean, I remember my first guy, the first really good guy I hired was, I was in business for myself, and I had this office in the basement of a private house, and I had this Italian guy working for me, and we would, you know, sell and deliver brochures. I mean, we were in the brochure business, he would do some of the heavy lifting, and then, okay, I'll tell you my first great idea, right? I was in the brochure business for 5 years. This is a story like Yosef in prison, you know, except I didn't feel like I was in prison. But for 5 years, this is what I did after school, right? I went to Harvard, I should have done something smart, right? No, I had a van. And I pick up brochures from like the Killington ski area, the Empire State Building. And I drive around to all the hotels on the East Coast and deliver the brochures, the little racks I had around me. And I would charge them like a couple hundred dollars a month to deliver the brochures. I was earning a good living and I liked it. I like enjoyed the work. I enjoyed it. You know, now I just enjoyed it. I thought I was being a great business. You know, that somehow this would be a great enterprise, you know, and people were dumping cigarettes on my head when they were looking at the brochures, you know. And this one day I was sitting in the office of this black sales manager for a company called Piedmont Airlines in Washington. And I used to deliver brochures also to military bases. And one of the best places you find for leads for brochures are the brochures that are already there. Right? Somebody put them there. It was not a professional. So sometimes I'd see a brochure for a hotel from Chicago or San Francisco, say they have a special rate for military travelers. So I call them, I say, listen, we deliver to all the military bases, and, you know, send us like 8,000 brochures, and we'll charge you $200 a month, and, you know, we'll deliver them. But we always lost the clients after 2 or 3 months because they couldn't afford a little hotel to print so many brochures and pay so much to the distributor, you know, which means it didn't even make sense for them to put out one, but, you know, whatever. So I say to this guy's office, and I had this idea. What if I put out a directory? I have two stories to tell you. I said, what if I put out a directory that listed all the military rates of all the hotels in the country, and I would charge them $25 a month for the listing, and I'll give the books for free to the soldiers. You know, the government had a book, but they charged $12. So I did it. I mean, I walked out of the office. I didn't even talk to the manager. I was so excited by this idea. You know, I sent out my first letter. 1,000 hotels signed up. $25,000 a month. I was only getting $200 to deliver a brochure. You know, and the book still comes out today. It's become weaker now because of the internet. But at its peak, it used to have like 3,000 hotels paying $50 a month, you know, to be in this thing. And it was just a fantastic, it was great. And then I had this, and then I hired this guy. I decided, you know, maybe I started to put out a book in Japanese for Japanese travel agents, and I wanted to sell ads. You know, people want to advertise it in Japanese. And I had this friend, and he was like, he had like an ad job. He was like an assistant bank manager at United Mizrahi Bank. But he was so active in charities. Like, he was the guy for B'nai Akiva who was organizing, bringing the Lulavim and Esra game, and he was the guy who was driving the truck around with the sukkah on and blah, blah, blah. I saw how much, like, energy this guy had. So I said, Mark, you know, I mean, he makes $500,000 a year now or something on bonuses. But I said, Mark, come work for me. And he said, I want to do it. I'm going to do it. And he had a wife. She was a real steady cat, you know, but he wasn't like one of these guys, I'm going to ask my wife. It's just, I'm going to do it. So don't you want to ask your wife? No, I'm just going to do it. So, you know, so then I started telling him before, I was thinking beforehand. When I used to have to fire somebody, I'd be up all night. I would like throw up. And he says, oh my God, I'm hiring a firm guy and his wife's, you know, not going to have a living and blah, blah, blah. And I was trying to convince him, don't come. Yeah, he said, no, it's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. And, so, and he came on, and it was fantastic. I mean, he sold all sorts of ads and so forth. So, I mean, you could see people who have exceptional talent in some other area. I mean, I guess I'm a little lacking in guts, you know. I have a little more guts now than I had then, but, you know. But, you know, I was afraid to put somebody to expose them.
I know that... I know that Mr. Jonas has a business meeting in a few minutes downtown.
Yes.
Well, I want to, on behalf of BMP, I want to thank Mr. Jonas for coming and sharing. We wish you continuous success in everything you're doing and helping Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.